the Access Subcommittee of the House Committee on Health Care to order and open a work session on, before I open a work session, let's talk about schedule. We'll do this work session, I think it will be rather quick. The intention is to move, to amend the bill in front of us and move it on to the full committee. We're going to have a panel of insurance executives that want to respond to the health insurance report of the insurance division, and we will end that precisely at 4 o'clock if it hasn't ended sooner, and open a public hearing on HJR 18 at that time. So I will now open a work session on 2348. We have in front of us an amendment to 2348, which I understand meets almost everybody's language. The council has warned us that the possible inclusion of one set of numbers at the end, you'll find on the last page of the bill, might get that to include group coverage. I think that might is a weak might, and we don't see why it would since it's under the individual coverage, but even if it does, that might not be a bad idea. The only objection that I have heard so far is from one insurance company who believes it will affect some of their business, and we've heard that, but I think we had agreement before for most of the insurance companies that if we took disability out, they would not have a problem with it, and I understand in the case of most of the insurance industry, that remains the case. So I would accept a motion to amend 2348 with the dash 5 amendments. Representative Minnis?
So moved.
Thank you. Any objections to that amendment being added? The amendment is added to House Bill 2348. And I would accept a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2348 dash, with the dash 5 amendment to the House floor.
Full committee.
Sorry, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to move 2348 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Kahn?
Aye.
Representative
Minnis? Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Reed?
Aye.
The motion passes. Representative Cannon, would you carry that to the floor?
Sure.
I mean to the full committee. There are several members here who aren't on the full committee, so it's a poor choice. It's he or you, man.
I'll defer.
You got it. Let's close the work session on House Bill 2348 and open an informational meeting on health insurance in Oregon. We have a panel. Will join us. Well, I'd like them to come and identify themselves.
Oh, you know who it is?
Oh, here we go. Yeah, Mike Becker, Dan Field, John Pierce, and Ken Robicher. Robicher. I didn't read my own agenda. I'm sorry, team. It's been about 50 minutes.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Ken Proventure. I'm the president and CEO of Pacific Source Health Plans based in Springfield, and I've been elected the lead-off speaker of this August group. My comments are going to be more global. I'm going to sort of set the table for the discussion, and then These very distinguished groups of experts will expound on a number of the points and speak in much more detail. Just for your information, I've been in the industry a little over 20 years. I've been at Pacific Source for a little over 12, and I've been CEO for the last six or so. I'm going to focus my comments on sort of the state of the industry and the competitive landscape in Oregon, because I think it's unique, and I think it's important as we consider legislative solutions and we look at regulation that it's important that we recognize how Oregon is different. I think the insurance division report did an excellent job of laying out what the industry looks like and how it works, and we thought we'd give you our perspective on that. I'd like to start with a little bit of a description about Pacific Source. I think it's useful because it speaks to some of that uniqueness, and there's a number of companies within the state that share some of the similarities with us and some of the features that we have. Pacific Source will celebrate its 75th anniversary next year. We were founded in 1933 by physicians in Lane County to serve basically employees of the timber industry in Lane County. Today we operate in all parts of Oregon, covering about 150,000 people who either purchase their insurance as individuals or through employers that we insure. An interesting aspect of Pacific Source is that we're a taxable not-for-profit. And if you look at the eight major players in Oregon, and we're an unusual market in that we have eight major players, but if you look at the eight major players in Oregon, six are either not-for-profit entities or they're owned by not-for-profit entities, which is also a very different aspect. There aren't many markets across the country that have that kind of presence of very regionally based carriers, and particularly not-for-profit carriers. And we represent that group in a very interesting way. What's interesting about us being not-for-profit, we are taxable. What's interesting is that it means that we have no owners, which means in turn that we have no access to equity markets. So all of our capital comes from our earnings, particularly since the company is committed not to leverage itself and bring on debt. Essentially everything that we invest in the company, all the reserves that we build, comes from the earnings that obviously we earn. We have a community-based board, as do many of the other entities, with a real fierce commitment to our independence. If you look across the country, there aren't a whole lot of companies that look like us that are regional, not-for-profit, with a real community-based. And again, Oregon's fairly unique in that it has a number of us that look somewhat similar. We have a real community focus because that's where our roots are, and we have maybe more than a company that has shareholders and particularly that's publicly traded. We have a real long-term focus. We can invest in some things that don't make sense in the short term that have a long-term benefit. We can Pacific Source is looking at opportunities to develop products that will serve the uninsured in Lane County and in Central Oregon, and they may be products that don't have the kind of margins that we see in some of our other business, and as a not-for-profit entity, we can take those kinds of positions. The company has a strong record of performance, consistent performance. If you look at us, we have very strong service metrics. We have low administrative costs, as do just about all the carriers in Oregon. We have pretty consistent profitability. If you look at us over the last 10 years, our profit margin sits right around 4%, which actually is high compared to probably the mean or the median. And in the last couple of years, it's been higher than that. But if you look over the long term, our target is 4%. And given that that's where all our capital comes from, hitting that over time is important. But it is interesting that if you look over a 10-year period, we're right at our target, which is the amount we think we need to continue to build our reserves, invest in information technology, and all the kinds of things that's required to be successful in our business. We have a strong balance sheet. If you look at measures of
can I interrupt you?
You bet.
I was waiting for you to take a breath. You probably haven't all seen me do it, but I modeled the behavior of shutting off my cell phone. It would be great if all of you shut it off, not just turned it to silence. Cell phones and BlackBerrys, because it screws up the recording system. The recording system on my phone goes up. I'm sorry, Ken.
It's the only breath I'm going to take. Our risk-based capital, which is a measure of our capital strength relative to our underlying premium and risk, is just under 600%. That may not mean a lot, except that it's considerably above the statutory level when you look in the long term, not at extremely high levels in terms of what's required to manage the underlying risk and to, as I said, continue to invest in the things that we need to do. Our board has taken a position that we're supportive of universal coverage, and I think that many of the carriers in Oregon have done the same. We would encourage the legislature to consider alternatives that are fiscally transparent and fiscally responsible. I think one of the concerns that we would have is that we would go the direction that some other states have gone, and we would put solutions in place that we probably haven't figured out how to pay for. And I think Massachusetts may be in that category as they move through time. Oregon is truly a unique competitive landscape. I've touched on some of the points already. It is unique in just a number of very significant carriers. If you look across the country, most markets are dominated by four or five of the top publicly traded companies with not a lot of regional presence. We're a fortunate market in having the amount of choice that we have and the options that exist. As I said, there are many regionally based not-for-profit plans, which is highly unusual. In spite of the fact that premiums are much higher than any of us would like to see, competition definitely impacts pricing. If you look at the experience over the last 2 years, trends, the relative increase in pricing, even though prices remain way beyond what we'd like to see, pricing has come down there. The rate of increase is significantly lower than it was, and that's directly due to competition. In fact, I might argue that some of the pricing we're seeing is not justified by the underlying claims, but we're seeing competition have an impact on pricing. Competition also impacts innovation. If you look at products in this market, the state was quick to introduce products that offered health savings accounts and health reimbursement arrangements. The level of competition that exists definitely promotes innovation. We've seen innovation on a consumer engagement side where really every one of the players in Oregon is looking for ways to get information to their consumers and help them move through the system. We're going to make some more detailed comments about transparency, and I know that's a hot topic in the legislature. But much of what carriers are looking at are finding ways to get information to their customers so that they can make better decisions in the system. And competition definitely supports that. Some just very quick general comments that folks will talk about more. One thing I think you need to seriously consider is what you do in terms of regulating reserves. Regulating reserves, in our opinion, would seriously disadvantage and disproportionately impact locally based not-for-profit health plans. Our only source of capital is the capital that we have. Our capital doesn't exist in other states. It doesn't. We don't have access to equity markets. And some others will talk to this point in greater detail. I would hope, and I would assume, that you would take a very comprehensive approach to health reform, that you would look for fiscally transparent, responsible ways to expand coverage and reduce the numbers of uninsured. I assume that you already know and work from the assumption that this is not just an insurance problem. The cost in the system is a significant issue. The nature of the delivery system and its ability to manage care and deliver care in a way that is most effective is one issue that has to be addressed as we look at. If we just add people to coverage without addressing those issues, we're going to end up with a bigger cost problem and a bigger access problem in the long run. And I hope you would look at comprehensive proposals that look at those kinds of solutions. I would hope that you'd consider the cost impact of regulation as how it fits into that big formula. To the extent that we pass regulation that impacts at the micro level, we create other issues. There are always, and there are, great proposals to mandate additional coverage. To the extent that we raise the cost of coverage through those mandates, through any willing provider laws, through additional administrative burdens, we push additional folks out of coverage, either because employers can't offer the coverage or because their employees don't pick up dependent coverage that becomes that much more expensive. And so while we're adding folks to the rolls over here, we're losing them on the other side, and that's a significant challenge. And then I'd hope that you'd balance the appropriate role of regulation versus market competition. And transparency might be one of those areas that I think that market competition may be achieving the objectives that you'd have as well as regulation might. With that, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mike Becker, and I thank you very much for this time.
Chair Greenlich and members of the subcommittee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm the Director of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs. Regents appreciates the opportunity to discuss the recommendations of health insurer financial performance and surplus contained in the January 2007 DCBS report, Health Insurance in Oregon. Overall, we congratulate the department on the tone and balance in this report, but we urge caution in rushing to judgment about excess insurer profits and surplus and the need for additional regulation. Health insurance is a very cyclical business, subject to numerous influences beyond the control of the insurers and beyond the control of the regulator. And Oregon, as we've heard, is a very competitive market, and perhaps the most competitive market in the United States. New regulatory models can easily lead to unintended consequences, such as market instability with carriers moving in and out of the marketplace, vast swings in premium rates, lowered credit ratings for insurers, increased administrative costs and lack of efficiency, and limited consumer choice by way of products and insurers. In my remarks today, I'd like to cover three general areas. First, a little bit about carrier financial performance from a more long-term perspective. Secondly, a little bit about reserve levels and RBC. And thirdly, about why positive financial performance is actually a good thing. So back to that first topic, carrier financial performance. In regard to net income, when you look at the long term, and what I'm talking about is the past 10 years as reflected in figure 3.4 and 3.5 and on page 19 of the report, you'll see that the average long-term net income for all carriers is less than 2%, and that's the same number for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, the largest carrier in the state. Regents net income, when you go back in time to 2003, you'll see that we actually had a 5% net loss in 2003, a 2% net gain in 2004, a 6% gain in 2005, and about a 5% gain through September 30th of 2006. The positive financial results of the past 2 years are a direct result of our success in holding down costs and effectively managing care and claims expense. Regents began aggressive actions in 2003 to better serve our members, to further reduce our operating expenses, and strengthen our competitive position in the marketplace. Secondly, long-term underwriting gains and losses. These are the operations of the health insurers. When you look at a five-year period from 2001 through 2005, Regents shows a 0% gain or loss from underwriting operations. The average for all carriers in the state over the same period of time is 2%. These are very modest financial returns from operations, particularly when you compare them to all industry nationally, which runs at a 6 to 7% average operating gain across the country. Administrative expenses in relation to premium. Regents and other carriers over the long term have an average of 8% administrative expenses. This is an amount indicative of a very significant efficiency in holding down costs. And despite the ballooning that we have seen in overall health care costs for the past 30 years, the industry-wide administrative cost has remained at about 13 cents for 30 years. And this is a national statistic as shown in the New England Journal of Medicine, August 2003. Turning to my second topic, reserve levels and RBC. If you look at figure 3-6 in the report, you'll see a comparison of carrier surplus trends. And there appears to be a marked difference between the for-profit carriers and the not-for-profit carriers in regard to those surplus levels. There is a simple explanation for this, and it was already alluded to, that for-profit carriers have access to capital markets through the issuance of stock and other equities, and they do not rely as heavily on surplus levels and surplus reserves for sources of capital, whereas not-for-profit carriers have to rely exclusively on those sources and operating income for capital expenditures. Reserves are particularly necessary for not-for-profit carriers to meet unanticipated financial events, pandemics, and other natural disasters. And these reserves form a safety net for our members. Reserves must also be proportionate to risk. Health insurance is a very volatile industry, and if you look at Figure 3.9 on page 23 of the report, you'll see that carrier underwriting results have fluctuated well into the red and well into the black over the past decade. The total surplus that Regents carries at this time is $467 million. That sounds like a lot of money, but as the largest carrier in the state, when that number is reduced to a calculation on a per-member basis using the 2005 numbers of insureds as reflected in the report, for those 420,000 insureds, that comes out to just over $1,100 per insured. That is a very modest sum when you consider the insurer's duty to make good on our contractual obligations to policyholders, even when facing these natural disasters such as a flu pandemic.
I think it's time for a question or two, if you don't mind.
Yes.
An interruption.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, when is enough enough? We got 10 times the minimum that's required, and so you got 1,000% surplus. And I'm just wondering, when is enough enough?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Richardson, actually, when the national actuaries who have independently looked at that issue, there is no easy answer to when enough is enough. This amount, $1,100 per member, is, as I say, a very modest sum when you look at the potential risk to our members from a natural disaster or a pandemic.
Certainly if a pandemic affected 420,000 members, we would be in serious problem if each had a $1,000 additional bill. But it's very unlikely that 420,000 people would be struck by the same pandemic, and so I don't think the reasoning really holds up. I'm just wondering if there's any standard as to when enough reserves for a nonprofit is enough, and maybe the nonprofit's no longer a nonprofit. It's a bank. Okay. Just wondering.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Richardson. I would turn your attention to the analysis in the Hay Report, which is attached to my testimony, as well as the analysis of the Lewin Group. And both of those national actuarial firms have independently looked at that issue and come to the conclusion that there is no standard that you can point to as the maximum amount of reserve or RBC that is adequate based on the risk. It varies from carrier to carrier. It varies from marketplace to marketplace. It varies based on the risk that each carrier has in their book of business.
Can I try that a little bit? Because you have a very puzzled panel here. And you know, I have even taught accounting on occasion. But I'm very much confused, say, Ken's statement of having a 600% surplus leading to a 4% return. And the question of how does surplus, reserve, and return relate to each other? I think that's the kind of puzzlement. I mean, we know you need to put some money away in a reserve. And we can discuss how much that amount has to be, but any carrier has to have a reserve in case something happens. I understand that. How does the surplus relate to the reserve, and how does the whole thing relate to the return? I mean, does money come out of the surplus into the reserve as an operating expense or something, and then what's left becomes the return? I can only speak for myself, but I suspect we're all pretty confused with this.
Chair Greenlick, the concepts of reserve and surplus are two separate things.
Uh-huh, I know.
Reserve is the statutory amount that carriers must have for the minimum number of insured that they have. Surplus is that amount that is held for the potential claims that the carrier may face. There is yet another measurement of carrier strength and financial strength to meet those obligations, and that is the NAIC's RBC calculation. The NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. They have come up with a calculation called RBC, which reflects the amount of risk that a carrier must have, and it takes a snapshot in time looking backwards based on everything in the carrier's portfolio by way of the risk makeup, the investments they hold, everything in that portfolio, looking backwards, what is the minimum necessary for that carrier to stay in business.
Let's see if I can try my question again. I'm obviously not communicating very well. Let's take a single year. Mm-hmm. And Pacific Source has a 600% surplus. It had a certain reserve coming into the year. And now it has a 600% surplus, which means it's a certain amount of dollars of revenue over current expenses, which are current claims and current administrative expenses. So now there's a certain amount more than that. What happens to that 600%, or your 1,000%, that eventually ends up in a 2% or a 4% return and an increase to the reserves? I mean, what happens to that money?
Chair Greenleaf, those are actually two different concepts. First off,
I want to have them as one concept, so would be very helpful if you don't redefine my question. My question is, there's a surplus. Those are dollars, right? 600% surplus means X dollars. I don't know what that number is, but 40 million, 80 million, a billion. That's a surplus. Am I defining surplus right? It's this year's revenue over cost. Is that the correct? That's the correct definition of surplus?
Chair Greenleaf, I believe that's an oversimplification of what surplus is.
Well, you could confuse it a bit, but the question is, how is it an oversimplification?
Okay, let me go back to your issue of what happens with. Are you asking what happens to the interest earned, the earnings on that surplus?
No.
No. Okay.
Surplus is an annual measure. It's not a cumulative measure. Is that right?
It's a measure at Chair Greenleaf. It's a measure at any point in time in a carrier's history. I mean, you can do a surplus calculation at any point in time.
Would profit be a better term?
No. Well, I mean, that's what I'm trying to find out. I'm trying to find out whether it's an annual measure or a cumulative measure. You have surpluses year to year. Are those cumulative, and do those relate to the reserves plus something, or? Well, tell me what that surplus is. I won't oversimplify your problem.
Okay, Chair Greenleaf, yes, the surplus is carried over year to year. The earnings on the surplus are part of the calculation of net income, as well as earnings from operations or losses from operations. Those two figures go into net operating income or revenue. If there is an increase overall from earnings on surplus and or earnings on operations, the net of those figures, if it is positive, is an increase to surplus. If it is a negative figure, it is a decrease to surplus.
Can I go back to Ken with me? Ask a question. You had 600% surplus. Is that right? How many dollars is that 600% surplus?
Chair Greenleaf, I believe our surplus is about $120 million, excuse me.
And what's your reserve?
That represents, I wouldn't differentiate that much between the two terms, to be honest with you. There's a statutory level. So I would really say it comes down to two terms, what our reserves are essentially and what our earnings are. The two are somewhat independent. So,
no, I know. And is surplus and reserve synonymous?
Not exactly, because one is more statutory related than the other, but we're essentially talking about the same thing.
I want to try something, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Teacher.
I do have to explain that I spent 30 years as a corporate officer of a company that had something related to this. So if I'm having trouble with your explanation, I don't know whether it's a definitional problem or whether it's just me and not everybody else is having this problem.
Well, let me give it a shot. It doesn't go directly to what you're talking about, but I think it gets to the same, ultimately to the same place, which is that our regulatory department, DCBS, tells us that in order to ensure your financial solvency, which I understood was the primary regulatory role they play to ensure us as patients and customers that you guys are not going to go insolvent when there's something really bad happens, that in order to do that, you need to have a certain level of surplus. And that's represented on these graphs in this chart by that lower low.
And a certain level of reserves, which they testified were two separate things.
So, and I see that amount as this lower sort of slightly sloping chart for most of you. Then I see what the actual amount in your surplus is, a really steep line, and the gap between that actual amount and what DCBS says is required for you to remain solvent is growing, getting really wide. And my question is, why is that necessary? Is DCBS wrong when they say that you don't need more than the, in Pacific Sources case, $38.9 million in 2005? You don't need the 100. I don't mean to put words in their mouth, but that's how I understood it.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon. The statutory level, so the required level of reserves, of surplus, is what's defined in the law, which is the 100% risk-based capital level, which has been referred to. That's a very minimum level of requirement. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners would not say that's an adequate amount to operate an insurance company based on the underlying risk and the total amount of premium. So in our case, $38 million in reserves, for example, is less than 1 month's claims. We pay greater than 1 month's claims. We're paying about $40 million in claims. If we had the minimum statutory requirement, and actually I think the insurance division would be living with us if we were at that level. I think we'd be under watch at that level. So that's a minimum statutory level. In fact, the amount of capital that's required to start a company in Oregon is a fairly minimal amount. The total reserves reflect how much capital do we need to manage the underlying risk and the total premium. And so to go back to the question relative to earnings and the total surplus and reserves, we could have a year where we hit our earnings target of 4%. But if we took on a fair amount of new business, particularly towards the end of the year, and added significantly to the risk of that business, we actually could see our risk-based capital level drop. So we could be hitting our budget and actually building our reserves at the level that we would like to build it. And given the underlying risk of the business and the addition of additional business, our risk-based capital level could actually drop. So the two concepts operate somewhat independently. What we found is that if we budget a level of 4%, we continue to build our reserves at an adequate level to be able to both meet the risk requirements and, two, to be able to invest in information technology and all of the underlying things that we need to do. We've done that out of operations over the last number of years.
Let's keep going. We only have another.
Chair Greenlick, part of the difficulty of assessing how much reserves or surplus is sufficient is the whole impetus behind why the NAIC developed the RBC model, the risk-based capital model. And if you look at that model and what it measures, the capital adequacy in a frozen state based on today's facts, it's not a predictor of the future. But if you look at Regent's RBC level, currently it's at 943%. But as recently as 2002, that RBC level was as low as 385%. Again, reflective of the risk that we have, the investments that we have, the enrollment that we have, and the products that we offer in this marketplace, among other factors.
Mr. Becker, we've got 20 minutes more.
and two other people to testify. How about if we divide that 20 minutes up among them?
And I will wrap up here. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Positive financial growth is a good thing. As a not-for-profit company, Regents does not have shareholders or others to whom we owe dividends. Any gain that we make stays with the company and is invested in the communities that we serve. Regents also pays taxes. We are a tax-paying not-for-profit. Our Oregon and local tax bill for 2005 was $4.3 million, and we paid $6.2 million toward the Regents Group's $78 million in federal income tax liability in 2005. In addition, we were assessed more than $10 million for the high-risk pool. Positive cash flow allows us to lower premium rates. It allows us to offer competitive products and services. It allows us to offer member educational programs and care management tools and technology that help hold down costs and keep our members healthy in the long term. You'll see attached to my written testimony an addendum of those types of investments that we have made in care management. And I'd like to draw your attention to two of them in particular. What Regents is doing by way of transparency, we have been at the forefront of the transparency movement in this state for the past 4 years, working with the Purchasers Coalition, with other carriers, and with the insurance department to bring macro transparency as well as micro transparency at the member level to our members, both by way of quality and cost data. Secondly, I'd like to draw your attention to the Regents Pharmacy Management Program, which is a comprehensive program that brings clinical-based medication review to our members and physicians. We've received national recognition, and we've actually gotten, because of the number of members in our pharmacy management, over 3 million, we've actually gotten drug manufacturers to produce unpublished studies and undertake comparative medication trials. We outreach to our members and physicians. We have a generic drug distribution program for generic drug detailing. We offer direct pharmaceutical contracting. We don't go through outside pharmacy benefit managers, and we have over 50,000 retail pharmacies in our network. In summary, having a positive financial underwriting result and a healthy reserve level has enabled Regents and other carriers to competitively price our products and moderate premium rate increases in the single digits through 2006. This has enabled us to increase enrollment and reduce the ranks of the uninsured, both of which benefit consumers. And this is shown in the competitiveness of the Oregon marketplace. It's also reflected in the recent report of the Oregon Health Policy and Research Commission showing the moderation in the uninsured levels in Oregon compared to the other states nationally. Having a positive underwriting result also allows us to invest in these innovative systems and product designs for our members. And with that, I would like to thank you for considering these comments. Regents is proud of the innovation that we bring to the marketplace, to our groups, to our physicians, to our members. And we continue our efforts to transform healthcare in this state and the financing and delivery of healthcare to all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is John Pierce. I'm General Counsel and Vice President for LifeWise Health Plan of Oregon. And I had planned to do four things here today, and given the questions that have come from the chair and the members of the committee, I think I'd like to add a fifth. And what I'd like to do is to talk about some contextual comments around the report itself and talk about that. I'd like to talk a little bit about LifeWise performance and within that expand a little bit to my fifth point and try to put some context, at least from where I sit, in terms of some of the questions that have been asked, which I think are obviously very good questions. Talk about rate regulation and how that applies to the notion of excess surplus, and then finally talk about a single example of what LifeWise is doing out in the marketplace that we think is responsive to the kinds of issues that are raised in the report.
Sounds like a lot to do in 10 minutes, but take a shot at it.
Thank you, and I will not repeat my colleagues. I support what they've said so far, and will avoid being repetitive. Certainly, we support the notion of making access in the state as strong as it can be, and commend the work that's been done by Director Streisinger and Administrator Ario in terms of putting out the report. We think it helps foster the debate around these issues, and we welcome that debate. We would urge the committee to look at the underlying cost of health care. We think that is really what is driving the cost of health care and health care insurance, and we need to make sure that we don't lose focus of that point. It's those costs that are really driving what the insurance companies need to charge to make sure that we can continue to stay in business. In terms of LifeWise and its financial performance, I'm actually going to comment, given some of the questions, on our holding company system. We're at about 575% risk-based capital. And to me, that means a point in time what our, if you will, money in the bank is. I don't mean to oversimplify the terms because I know that you're all very, very expert in this field. But surplus or reserves is really what we have in the bank, and then the margin in any particular year is what we're able to do business based on and either add to or subtract from that surplus. In our case, over the last 10 years, our margin amount has been 3% over those 10 years, which allows us not only to stand and pay the obligations we have to our members, but also do productive things that we're going to talk about in a few minutes in terms of responding to the market needs. We do believe that, as the report indicates, that there is moderating in the market, both for individual products and for group products, and we think that that is a good point in the report. And we also are looking at providing the kind of timely and meaningful information to our members that the report calls for. I do want to talk a little bit about the notion of surplus regulation. I've actually followed that very closely up in the state of Washington. As one of the previous testifiers stated, there has been a report up there commissioned by the insurance commissioner to look at the issue of how much is enough, when is too much surplus too much. And they did come back and saying that there is no objective standard, that a regulator should not use RBC to try and regulate the upper ends, that should be left to the companies and shouldn't be done on a sort of, we'll know too much when we see it. And having been involved in the healthcare market up in the state of Washington in the last 15 years, I was directly involved in the individual market and the meltdown of the individual market in that state, which was in part caused by overzealous legislation and regulation that ended up with every one of the health plans either ceasing to sell insurance in the state of Washington on an individual basis or leaving the state entirely. And that is the kind of thing I think that the committee should be mindful of as they go about doing their business to make sure that we don't have that kind of unintended consequence of rate regulation. And that is one of the things that the Lewin Group report did point out, is that with surplus regulation, without more, there are the potential consequences of either driving companies out of the state or driving them out of business. And that is a reality. And then finally, I did want to talk about a program that LifeWise is putting in place where we have a product that will allow, in the first instance, hospitals to calculate what a member's cost share would be when they go into the hospital. So in advance, they will know, based on the procedure, based on where the procedure is going to be performed, based on the history for that particular member, the hospital will know exactly what it's going to charge them when they come in. And I know a couple of the members of the committee have been exposed to that product. And that is the sort of thing, I don't mention that to necessarily talk about what LifeWise is doing in the market, because each one of us is doing our own innovative things. I offer it as the kind of innovation that I think you get to with a free market, as opposed to a regulatory approach, which I, over the years, have seen really get to a lowest common denominator as opposed to a best practice. And so we definitely encourage the dialogue around the work that the commission has done, and we, in particular, want to focus on allowing the marketplace to perform, because it does perform well in this state. We have a competitive environment. We have a robust system in place, and we think that should be preserved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good job. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to actually comment on something Representative Richardson said about the pandemic flu and how that could play out. Predictions are that if it hits, 30% of our population is going to be impacted. Mm-hmm. And so if you take even less than that, something like a quarter, and you do it for one hospital stay, because most of these people are going to require vents, or a lot of them will require vents, and you have a lot of people die, I mean, you're going to run through that reserve in a matter of weeks. It's not going to be a matter of months. It's going to be weeks. So I look at these reserves as
If I may just respond to that, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
From the standpoint of my system of holding company, including the companies in Washington, we actually, because of a couple of major accounts, we're at the point of approaching insolvency. We're actually on the watch list of the National Blue Cross Blue Shield Association because of the level of our risk-based capital. And we have come back from that point, and I'm happy to say that we're being financially successful in that regard. But it doesn't take very much to get to that point. And I think the last thing any of us want is not to have health plans being able to respond to the obligations that they have to their members in those kinds of circumstances.
Let me try, if I may, the question in a different way that I was trying to get Mr. Becker to deal with. You as an organization, and let's not get confused with the holding company, but just your existing company, at the beginning of the year has some money in the bank. You have some assets. Some of those are cash or cash-like assets, and some of them are others, but you have some assets. And then you have this year's experience, and in the year you have some money that comes in that's over your expenses. And that money, something happens to that money, right? And some of it goes in. I mean, is that money your 4%? Or is
the 3% I referred to would be the net during that year, the amount by which income was greater than costs.
Right.
To make it very simple.
So then you've got the 3%, and some of it you add to the reserves. That will begin the next year, right?
In that example, all 3% does go into the reserves, in your example, because other things are paid out of before you get to that 3%.
So yeah. It now goes into the reserves, and you have last year's reserves, assuming you didn't spend anything, what you started the year with, plus an additional 3% of your volume. Does any of those numbers relate to surplus, as the insurance commission calls it?
I think we do get caught up a little bit in our industry in the nomenclature. Basically, it is surplus. That term is defined differently and used differently in different circumstances. But conceptually, I think the point you're trying to get to is the surplus. That is, if you will, to use my term, the money in the bank. And out of that, we need to look at growth opportunities. We need to be ready for things like Y2K. In one of the earlier examples, as we grow the number of members that any of us have, then that starts to affect how that reserve level, how it turns into the RBC, our risk-based capital calculation, which is really sort of taking that number and equating it to what is the risk. How should that really be considered in terms of to the riskiness of your business?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Let me just one thing.
Sure.
Before we go forward. Concern that we have is the cost of insurance is becoming so great for the constituents that we want to make sure that there is some relationship between the profits, the surplus, and the costs. And so we look at Regents and we see that that as far as just take a look at recent changes in their individual plans, they went up 17% in 2004, up 9% more in 2005, and they went down 15%. In 06. Well, and if you look at the graph on the surplus, it continues. It's on this kind of a slope. Your company, which is LifeWise, it went up 12% in 04. The price went up 13% in 05 and up 6.5% in 06. But you're a stock company, and so I see the last 3 years you're kind of leveling off. Your surplus has gone up a little bit, but not too much. Kaiser, which has 1,050% surplus over what is required, went up 11% in 04, 8.7% in 05, and 12.8% in 06. And so when you've got 1,000% more than what is required and your premiums for individual plans go up 12.8%, when is enough enough? Because that's on the backs and the burdens of the people.
Well, that's a great segue. We have Kaiser representative next.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's the issue.
I'm Dan Field from Kaiser Permanente, and I will just dive right into it. I actually think the report from the insurance division is very well done, although I'm beginning to take exception with their presentation of reserve and surplus after the last 45 minutes. My understanding of reserve is that that's a subset of surplus, and the reserve is what's available to pay claims. Surplus speaks to all the money that an insurer has in the bank to operate their business, including capital investments and some other investments that I'll talk about in a minute. If you look just at Kaiser's numbers, for example, we have a $2.2 billion company. I'm looking at our financials here. We spent $171 million in the month of December alone on expenses. So under the insurance commissioner's presentation at $67 million, he would argue, I guess, by that presentation that we should have 12 days cash on hand. I don't think that's right. So what we actually have is the $360 million that's presented in the report, which is about, 60 days cash on hand, which is still a month less than financial advisors tell us we should have in our home checking account. So I would argue that we probably ought to have a presentation from the insurance commissioner, or at least somebody on his financial staff, to talk to us about the difference between reserves, which is necessary to pay claims, and surpluses, which is necessary to operate a business. Because I think arguing that we could, at Kaiser, where we have monthly expenses of almost $200 million, be prudent stewards of our resources and our members' money by having only $67 million on hand is simply not right. So clearly the committee needs to get more information about what those numbers mean and what the gap between that surplus number and the reserve number means. I want to just give you a little bit of an overview. I think the previous speakers, including Ken, did a great job of describing the Oregon marketplace. It is dominated by nonprofit insurers like Kaiser, Regions, Providence, Pacific Source. We have about 70% of the market. It's a very competitive market, as you can see from the report. Average annual net income of insurers is 5%. And the industry average, the industry average for that same 10 years is just 2%, with 5% in the most recent year. It can be a very challenging market. If you look at the first 5 years of that 10-year period, four out of the eight insurers either had a zero margin, we're talking about annual operating margin now, or they had a negative net margin. So that gives you a sense of it's a very cyclical industry. Those are not one or two insurance carriers. That's over half the marketplace. Unfortunately, as Representative Richardson points out, during the same 10-year period when insurers wrestled with maintaining positive margins, the cost of health insurance continued to rise for average Oregonians. As the report notes, average monthly premiums more than doubled from 1996 to 2004, not even a 10-year spread. And I would just note very quickly that although Oregon premiums continue to rise, we maintain a position about 10% below the national average, and I think that speaks to our lower cost structure. And then finally, it's a tragic statistic that many of us have heard before, but now if you take the average annual family premium, it is more than the wage earned by somebody working under a federal minimum wage. So it's a sad state of affairs that insurance now costs more than somebody can earn if you're in a single earner family at the minimum wage. Finally, as reported earlier, and I think this is the statistic that you folks are very focused on this session, very appropriately so, the Office of Health Policy told us earlier this month that about 15% of Oregonians are still uninsured, 12% kids are uninsured, and I think this committee is going to do something about that, has already. So I would argue that in a difficult environment like that, as we've seen here over the last hour, it's very appropriate for the committee to look at insurers and say, are you part of the problem or are you part of the solution? It's appropriate for you to ask us if we're managing our members and our insureds' dollars responsibly, and we appreciate the opportunity to begin this dialogue with you. I don't think we're going to answer all your questions today, but we need to start this dialogue and continue it throughout session.
Mr. Chair.
I guess Representative Minnis.
Thank you. Could you tell me what the major cost drivers are that makes the insurance increase? What are those major cost drivers?
Yeah, and I there's actually been a lot of research on that, and I'll comment and ask others to comment on that as well. But there's a great report, I believe it's by America's Health Insurance Plans, the National Trade Association, where they actually produce an annual report that does by percentage what the cost drivers are, so we should try to get that to the committee. My understanding is it's it's a number of things. Number one, it's the cost shift. This committee has heard testimony about the nature of the cost shift, and in Oregon that contributes about $1,000 a year to the average family premium, just subsidizing the cost shift from those who are uninsured. I think there's a tremendous demand for new pharmaceuticals. There's a tremendous demand for new treatments and technologies. We have all kinds of treatments that we didn't have even 10 years ago, medicated stents and other things like that, that people now are saying, I want to have that level of care. So when you add that in, it's really driving costs through the roof. I think one of the things that's not driving cost here in Oregon certainly is necessarily increased utilization. We aren't hospitalizing people more or for longer. In fact, as you folks know, we're one of the lowest utilizers in the nation on hospitalization. Wonder if others have comment about that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Minnis, I would draw the subcommittee's attention to a report by John O'Connell of OHSU. He has done a number of much analysis on the cost drivers as they particularly impact Oregon, and he has a study that he has presented to the Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform, and that study shows that technology overall is the major healthcare driver, cost driver. It's not just the increase in unit cost, but it is the additional increase in number of units delivered, new units of service, technology, drugs, procedures, and medical devices that we didn't even know about last year. And as those things enter the marketplace and that new technology comes online and we increase the number of services, all of that multiplies to drive healthcare costs.
We've got about 2 minutes, and I'll wrap up here so you can hit your 4 o'clock deadline.
Thank you.
Just quickly, I want to highlight three areas where Kaiser, and I think I'll talk about Kaiser, but by extension you can apply this to other insurers, uses of our surplus and uses of our margin. First of all, we reinvest in the community. We spent almost $35 million in 2006, and that number is roughly equivalent to the same amount of our operating margin, which was $38 million. So we're spending about $35 million in the community. I'll pass these out. These are 2005 community benefit report. It lets you know what Kaiser is doing. I think other insurers are doing a lot as well. One of the things we do is maintain a long-term commitment to the market, including lines of business that we know will remain unprofitable. Where we serve portability members, those are folks rolling off of group coverage onto individual coverage, lose millions of dollars a year on that. We serve Medicaid members, patients, lose millions of dollars a year on that. We also offer subsidized health insurance program. I'll leave this with the committee. This is a child health program that Kaiser is using to provide health care to over 2,000 school-age kids who don't qualify for Medicaid, don't qualify for group coverage. Spend millions of dollars a year on that as well. Having margins and surplus allows us to manage those unprofitable lines and remain committed to those year after year. In Washington, you saw where people came out of the individual market because it was losing money, and then they went back in. In Oregon, you have a group of carriers who remain committed to all the markets, including individual market, small group market, which is not a profitable market. It's less than 2% margin. And so having those margins allows us to remain committed to those market year after year and not be responsive to, can we make money in that this year or next year? And the final, just very quickly, final comment I would have is beyond our claims reserves, we're making major capital investments in the kinds of things that this committee and our members thinks are important. It takes a lot of money to buy the systems that allow people to go online and figure out what their deductible is, what their copay is going to be. In our case, we're implementing a multi-billion-dollar Kaiser Permanente Health Connect electronic medical record system that allows people to go online and see their health record in real time. Those are important expenditures that are directly for the value of our members. A lot of insurers are making those kinds of investments, and a 1.8% margin, which was Kaiser's margin last year, we made all of $38 million on $2 billion of revenue. We cannot fund that kind of technology and those kinds of investments in unprofitable lines of business on $38 million a year. So that's the use of the surplus.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on health insurance in Oregon. We're going to hear more about this, I think, and
yeah.
I really appreciate you opening up the process for us.
Thank you.
Ben Westland out there. We'll now open a public hearing on HJR 18. We'll invite Senator Westland to come up to the podium, or to the testimony stand, and also we'd invite our chair, Representative Greenlick, to kind of be a two-person panel here to discuss this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you letting me sit up here, saving the walk down. Who starts? Can you and me?
Well, I'm just feel awful lonely down here all by myself. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. You are the chair, Mr. Chair, so it is your call and your prerogative. Well, I sit here at this dais and actually kind of feel like it's deja vu all over again. If this bill looks familiar, you may recognize it as the original HOPE initiative that I was so proud, along with you and several others, to be the chief petitioner on last summer. And unfortunately, as we all painfully know, it fell just under the gathering of the signature requirement. But one of the things I would like to say is I gathered signatures, and I know you and your wife Harriet so nobly soldiered on when we were gathering signatures. I never found anything that elicited a more enthusiastic response from citizens on the street and their overall concern about health care. So here we are again, looking at an opportunity and a need that today is even greater now to cover all of our citizens, indeed every human being. And just as importantly, and this cannot be lost in the focus, to lower costs. I'd like to focus on one paragraph in particular, section 46, and this is a proposed new section in Article 1 of our Constitution, actually my favorite part of the Constitution, because this is the section that ascribes rights and privileges. And while over the years, I mean, obviously this is 46, there are many sections in Article 1, and while some of them have come and gone and reflected the thinking at the time of our founding of the original crafters, this section, again, ascribes rights and privileges, and it's just amazing to me that access to the fundamental human requirement and need of health care isn't covered in this section. And of course, this is what this effort is really all about, and what this legislation, HDR 18, is all about. But I want to stress that this just isn't about providing access to everyone, although I believe we have a moral imperative to do that. It's also about lowering costs for individuals, for businesses, public entities, and certainly the state. We must focus on effective, evidence-based care, cost-effective care, focus on affordable care. It's not unlimited care. There's nothing in this provision that says that this is access to unlimited care. It certainly is not. We must honor the time-proven principles of prioritized preventative care. It must be crafted in such, it must be economically sustainable. This resolution requires the Assembly to adopt a plan to incrementally expand health care to everyone. The Senate Commission that I co-chaired during the interim, which Representative Greenlick so ably served on, the Senate Commission on Healthcare and Affordability, comprised of legislators, healthcare advocates, industry representatives, and other stakeholders, met during the legislative interim this past year. And that commission, through a lot of hard work, produced the framework for comprehensive reform in a universal healthcare system that is economically sustainable and lowers costs. That concept was introduced to Senate Bill 329, and many of your committee members have been very dutiful and proactive in contributing to the Senate Commission's work in the Senate Special Committee on Health Care Reform, and for that I thank each and every one of you. You know, fundamentally, there are enough dollars in the system. Our job is to more effectively reallocate those existing dollars to better provide health care, not just to those that already have it, but those that currently don't. This effort, this resolution, goes a long way to incrementally helping to craft a system that will ultimately deliver health care to all our citizens at lower cost. And for that, Mr. Chair, if I may, Mitch, thank you so very much for your humanity. I appreciate you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Senator? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the kind words, Senator. Roughly 150 years ago, the founders, as Senator Westland just mentioned, created our Constitution and crafted in that Constitution the statement that every Oregonian has a right to a common system of schools. It took us about 70 years, by accounts, to achieve that, and we're still struggling with seeing what we can do to achieve a common system of schools, but it changed the nature of the state from the very beginning. Healthcare at that time wasn't seen as an essential commodity in the same way education was, and healthcare wasn't mentioned in that Constitution. Over the past 150 years, we've evolved a notion that healthcare is a fundamental right, although we've not codified that in any specific way. And what this resolution does is very simply ask the citizens of the state of Oregon to vote on the concept, is healthcare a right? And if it is, as a result of their vote, to put that statement into the Constitution. One hopes it wouldn't take 70 years to implement that, that right, but it will take a long time, even if the citizens do believe that's the right. Incidentally, the survey work we did over the past almost 2 years on this bill indicate about 75% of the citizens of the state agree with the concept that access to effective and affordable health care is a fundamental right of Oregonians and is the obligation of the state to ensure that that happens. This will test the extent to which that survey research is really correct. We did spend more than 15 months attempting to get onto the November 06 ballot an initiative very similar to this, similar to the to paragraph 1 with more detail in paragraph 2. And it was an extraordinary effort from people all around the state helped us work with. But it would have required us, to, in order to get the 101,000 valid signatures, about 145,000 signatures, and we ended up getting less than 120 signatures. Came 120,000 came in very close, and it was a huge effort on our part. But for a variety of reasons, we weren't able to make it to the ballot, and we're trying again in this session to have it referred to the ballot. Now, you all can read, but I'd like to read the essence of this, of what we would ask the citizens to vote on. And that's a statement that health care is an essential safeguard of human life and dignity, and there's an obligation for the state to ensure that every legal resident of Oregon has access to health care as a fundamental right. The Legislative Assembly, by law, shall adopt a plan that incrementally expands health care coverage so that every legal resident of Oregon is able to obtain effective and affordable health care on a regular basis. A very simple set of words, two sentences, But as we struggle with trying to achieve it, as many of our constituents are asking us, both in this committee and in the Senate committee, where we are trying to deal with the fact that there are currently 600,000 Oregonians without access to health care, without access to affordable and effective health care on a regular basis. We have what seems to me is a moral crisis. Of those 600,000, there's more than 100,000 are children, and we're trying to deal with them incrementally with a bill we passed out of here. But the fact is it an obligation of the state? Do our citizens believe that we have an obligation to incrementally provide effective and affordable health care? As we struggle with how to do this, and this is a very difficult thing to do, we continue to ask ourselves, are we doing this as a matter of right in the state? Is that what the citizens of Oregon want? And in fact, there's no way to find out unless we ask the citizens. So all we're doing with this amendment is to put that question to the citizens of this state once and for all in an election as soon as possible, and it's currently the next general election, although that could change if factors change by the time we get to hear this bill in the full committee. We simply want to ask the citizens, how do they feel on this issue, and are they willing to instruct us as legislators over the next session or the next two sessions or as we begin to work on this, do they really want us to take this job on? A very simple question and a very innocuous one, but one that has huge legal, economic, and moral consequences, and one that I will ask this committee to vote on and to move on to the full committee and ultimately to the floor. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions for either?
I have just a couple. Either yourself, Mr. Chair, or Senator Wesson can answer this. How much money is currently spent on our health care system?
About $17 billion in the state of Oregon is the estimates we have.
And
is that right, Mr. Vice Chair?
I've heard multiple.
Yeah, something like that, though. A lot of money.
More specifically, and this is only a partial answer, but gives you a pretty good idea, the last audited numbers we have, not including Medicare. So take the Medicare dollars, Medicare population off this calculation. Last audited numbers we have are in 2004, and the figure was we spend, as a state, all of us together, $10.6 billion. That was in 2004. Those numbers are probably roughly 20% higher now, with no end in sight to the escalation.
Plus Medicare.
Yeah, that does not include Medicare. And that's approaching, not quite, but twice as much as our general fund.
If we move this forward, what would you talk to the voters about as far as costs? To cover everybody, you made a statement that there's enough money in the system.
You go back and you just do the simple math the $10.6 billion. Even at those figures, 2004 figures, take out the Medicare dollars, the Medicare population. Again, these numbers are probably 20% higher now, and I think we can provide health care. You do that simple math, it's $350 per citizen per month. That's what we were spending in 2004. So I actually very much appreciate the question, because I think it illustrates that in the system itself, the corpus, the dollars are there. They just need to be more properly allocated.
Mr. Chair. So then your concept is to kind of capture all the dollars that are currently in the system and reallocate those dollars. So if somebody has a private insurance, how would that work?
That's really not my concept. So I think we really do need to make sure
that isn't my concept. But for example, right now, if somebody has private insurance, as we heard testimony from, they are paying as a part of the premium of that private insurance more than $1,000 a year to pay for the uninsured. We'd like to eventually work things out so that $1,000 a year isn't in the private health premium, but is being covered in some other way, because we are paying it now. The employers are screaming about their inability to compete on the world market because of that cost shift and because of the cost of medical care. What I believe can happen is we can provide health care for the 17% that don't have it without taking away real benefit from those that do. If we can make health insurance more effective, if we can make the health care system more effective, if we can take out things like the excess defensive medicine that malpractice fear brings, if we can do things that allow primary care to be given rather than having people show up first thing in the emergency room, we have lots of ways to create a more efficient system, so the current people with health insurance will be better off and the people without health insurance will be better off. And ultimately, there probably will need to be investment to get this moving, but ultimately, the cost of the healthcare system will be less per person rather than more per person. So I don't think we need to socialize the healthcare system. I don't think we need to take away real benefits from people that have it in order to serve the people that don't. I think we just need to find a way to make this whole system more efficient, and we're exploring that twice a week at 5 o'clock at night and how to do that.
If I could follow up just a little bit, and those are exactly the right questions, and those are questions that need to be answered and will be answered. But what HJR 18 is more than the specifics. It is much more important than that. It is a value statement. And what it allows is the citizens of Oregon to make a value declaration. This is what we believe. That's what this is really all about.
Other questions?
And if I could just comment on that. I think that certainly, you know, we all want health care for Oregonians. But I think the other part of the equation, Senator, is how do we get there? And this is yes, we want to take care of everybody, and certainly I don't think anybody in this room thinks that not having health care is a good thing. But the other part of the equation is how do we get there? And what does that mean?
Well, that's exactly right. This challenges us to find that path. It's very difficult to make the kind of decisions we need to make as a legislature without having, you know, sort of a mandate to deal with it. We're trying, but what this would do is say, over the next several years, start working on this. Let's move us along. And we may move along without this, but we might not.
Mr. Chair.
Does it matter?
Thank you. The debate on this is going to be probably captured in a couple bumper stickers. And I guess one of the arguments, and I'm playing kind of the devil's advocate because I'm looking, I don't know what your response is going to be, is that we, and there's many ways to attack this, but we don't traditionally pay for declare rights for services, with the exception of education.
Public safety.
Okay, public safety. But there are limits, and I don't know exactly the phraseology, but where are the limits in the state's responsibility to provide health care? And how, you know, to me this is pretty open-ended. I mean, looking at this, and but because the resources are limited, human capital is limited, and it's not always about dollars. It's about the reality that we may not have enough healthcare providers to provide something Where is the limit on this as a right?
If I may, over the years, in my participation in the Ways and Means process, I have come to see these budgets as moral documents. What we fund and what we don't fund, we are making very significant decisions that impact almost every Oregonian and much of what they do every day. I think it's important as we go forward to allow the citizens, when you go to back to the Constitution, I mean, what is that? I mean, it represents our values. And there are constitutional rights within that document that aren't free. More than free speech. More than the right of assembly. There are vital public services that are so valued by a given people, in this case Oregonians, that they were put with good purpose in the Constitution because it was a value. And I think everyone on this committee and everyone in the audience understands that access to a free, and we're not proposing that health care is free, but a free public education is a constitutional right. So I don't see much distinction, really, between some of those value statements already written into the Constitution by our citizens and this amendment. I obviously support it and believe, as a value, access to affordable, keyword, affordable, effective health care should be a fundamental human right. I think there's also another issue here. And I don't remember the quote exactly, but it's what constitutions, I feel, are primarily all about. Rights, privileges, and responsibilities. It was Martin Luther King that said something close to this, and that there can be no equality without equal access to health. That's part of what this is as well.
Thank you very much, Senator Wilson. I've got the gavel back. I appreciate you being here.
Well, I'm in trouble with my chair for leaving my committee. I appreciate very much the invitation to be here, and I appreciate each and every one of your interests.
You're probably just looking for an excuse, anyhow.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Is Rich Rohde here? I think not. That's too bad. We had hoped he would be here from Medford today, but it's a long drive. Janelle and Wydenitz? No? Yes.
Yes. Chairman Greenlink and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Wydance, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mouthful today. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today on House Joint Resolution 18. And on behalf of the 57 community hospitals and health systems across the state and the patients we serve, especially the uninsured people that we serve every day, we support this legislation and a referral to the public. Oregon is on the road to major health care reform that recognizes everyone's right to health insurance and access to quality health care. And this resolution can be a first step on that road. It empowers Oregonians to add their voice to this effort. It will provide the framework and the momentum needed to keep us on the road to health care reform. And together, in following years as an incremental approach, we can build a healthcare system that is sustainable, cost-effective, provides universal access, and provides quality of care and quality of life to Oregonians. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What is your thought of, what is your definition of incremental?
Chairman Greenlick, Representative Minnis, I think that that's the body coming back after a referendum or a mandate from the public and developing a system and carefully considering all the aspects to it instead of rushing towards a precipice and jumping off that. A slow and steady, careful consideration of all the aspects. So the issues of funding and the issues of quality and transparency and access, all of those issues can be worked out in a public forum so that when we get to the end of healthcare reform, we have those things that we are all talking about today, which is quality and access and transparency.
Please. Have you worked with the Senate Interim Committee that has spent considerable time on this issue already?
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Minnis, we have, as an association, been working very closely with the Interim Committee before I came on with the association, and since we've been also, since the beginning of session, working with that committee as well to discuss healthcare reform issues.
So would you think a model would be something like Senate Bill 329? Would you consider, and I'm not suggesting this, but maybe marrying up 329 with HGR 18? Would that be your concept of?
Chairman Greenlick, Representative Minnis, are you suggesting that you would amend this resolution and include Senate Bill 329 as referral to the public?
I'm just wondering, because they've spent, I know, considerable time. Would that be a concept, that particular concept? Is that something you would support?
We've actually reviewed many of the different healthcare proposals that are out there and reviewed them based on the principles that you actually now have, the committee members have, and that the board approved just recently on healthcare reform and what those principles need to be. We think Senate Bill 329 meets those criteria fairly well. I'm not sure if sending out a detailed plan that would necessarily be helpful for the public versus stating a right, especially in a constitutional amendment. I can think of other pieces where we've referred legislation or people have petitioned and gotten very specific language on into the Constitution, and then it's very hard to go back and fix even incremental things within that. So I think sometimes that the Constitution should be held sacred as a right. I think Senator Westland was very articulate about that. But holding that as a right and privileges and responsibilities and a document that has our values and our morals, and then the specifics comes in Oregon Revised Statute.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin Taylor. Mr. Martin Taylor, we have three other witnesses. I'm trying to get them all in tonight. Gail Atterbury, John Charles, and Ellen Pinney, in that order.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Appreciate the conversation. It's definitely a 10,000-foot look at a problem that we spend a lot of time in this legislative process seeing one detail at a time. So I appreciate the nature of this conversation. I think actually we do well to have these conversations on many of our core functions. What you're really discussing today, in my opinion, is whether or not healthcare falls in a category like public schools or fire or police or roads, which are things that everybody has access to regardless of their personal wealth. And we see those as sort of core functions of the relationship between government and the governed. Or whether it falls into a series of things that are more programs that we offer to some people and not others. Higher education, form of grants. It's not accessible to everyone. You have some burden to pay yourself. Shelter or food are things that are programs that we offer some people who have those needs, but we don't guarantee people shelter or food in the state. Healthcare is like that. Unless you're old enough, in which case you get Medicare, or poor enough, in which case you get Medicaid, or have an injury that requires you to go to an emergency room. So we have universal healthcare for some, or in some circumstances, but not everyone.
What you're really asking is, philosophically in our Constitution, do we move healthcare from a program to being something more like police, fire, roads, and public education? When I asked our members that, when the Hope Initiative came to us, it was very interesting the process that ONA came to its conclusion. I think at first a lot of the staff, myself included, were kind of skeptical. It seemed like this was a little bit of a Quixote-esque quest to talk about universal health care was always a little bit of a something that was too big for us to tackle. And it also seemed a little ambiguous. You know, what exactly do you even mean by health care? What's being covered? What's the benefit? How do you make that happen? And so we brought it to our leadership, and our leadership was less skeptical than staff, frankly. They're like, well, yeah, those are some good questions. We want to hear Representative Greenlick's answers to those questions. He was the point person on Hope. We want to sort of germinate on those, but those are always going to be the questions, right? There's never going to be a time when those aren't the questions. So the real question is, do we ever plan on answering them? Do we ever at some point expect to identify what a basic health care package is and how would you go about paying for it? And if the answer is we want to do that at some point, isn't this that point? And that was sort of where our members were at the leadership level. So we got involved. We supported Hope. We put in a small amount of money to, you know, sort of token contribution, and we started collecting signatures. We wanted to get one signature per member, and it's hard to collect signatures. So that was a lot of work, but it was a pretty marginal investment on our part. And as we started collecting signatures from our members, the thing we found is that even at the leadership level, we were a lot more cynical than our members. Our members were not enthusiastic. This was about the most important issue we'd put in front of them. And we didn't expect that reaction. We thought that healthcare workers would know the system well enough to feel intimidated by the prospect of saying that everyone was entitled to a basic healthcare benefit. And what we got back were healthcare providers who were citizens of the state, who by and large felt that as citizens of the state, this was a lot more like schools or roads or fire. It was just something that you ought to be able to expect. The security of knowing that if something happens in your life that's unpredicted, your life doesn't fall apart as a result of it. That you don't end up bankrupting yourself to deal with your health care. That you had basic primary and preventive care services so bad things happened less frequently. That you had a sick kid or a situation where you had a spouse who could no longer work, that that wasn't something that was going to permanently change the direction of your life, that you had the state to back you up. That was how our members looked at it. And frankly, I think that's why this polls so well. That's how the public looks at it. It's the kind of idea that once you put it out in the grassroots, it takes life. And so at the end of the Hope story, there was a desperate dash to get signatures, and our folks went all in. And I wouldn't have expected that. By the time we finished with the Hope Initiative, ONA had identified two priorities. We had been saying healthcare for all kids was our number one priority, but by the end of the signature collection campaign, it was very clear to us that putting something in there that recognized in the state constitution that this was a primary right of every citizen to have access to an affordable and effective healthcare system, that was one of the two things now that I was going to have to spend my time working on. And it's a pleasure to work on issues like this because they're not the parochial interest of nurses. They really are the interest of all Oregonians. So my members picked a course for me in the session to advocate on their behalf that wasn't about something that was just about nurses. It was about all of us. We've learned some lessons on the street that I want to share with you. I collected a lot of these signatures, as you can imagine. You can't ask your members to collect hundreds of signatures each without doing it yourself. So I was out there, and I interacted not just with nurses, but, you know, particularly the Rose Festival Parade. I was out there interacting with whoever happened to show up, many of whom were Oregonians, although I talked to plenty of folks from Washington State, too. Only collecting signatures from those that were valid, but, you know, having a lot of conversations. And the two things that came up the most were, one, this issue of citizenship. Should we really be providing a benefit that a non-citizen could use? Well, frankly, the Oregon Constitution protects the rights of Oregon citizens, so it was sort of a non-issue in the first Hope Initiative. This ballot measure is even more clear. It says every legal resident in Oregon. So I think that that concern was, you know, moved past. And the other was the affordability question. And I believe that that has been addressed in two ways in this version of the Hope Initiative. First, it says incrementally expands. You're not going to do things beyond your ability as a legislative body to fund them. Now, incrementally may take a while, but it may also be true that as you begin to expand coverage to health care, you find ways to control costs. And that's the second thing. It says affordable in this measure, and I think what Representative Greenlick says is true, that if you're going to find cost containment in the healthcare system, it is eventually going to require a commitment on the part of this legislative body to do some very hard things.
But in the process of doing those hard things, you are in fact going to be making a change in how we deliver healthcare services, a re-emphasis, a refocus that will in fact not just benefit those folks that are on the Oregon Health Plan or public employees who are getting their health insurance from the state, that are going to change the marketplace in Oregon, and they're going to benefit everybody who's having to pay for insurance, including individuals who are trying to insure themselves, people who are trying to insure small businesses, or organizations like ONA that insures 30 employees and are watching their health care costs go up, you know, 15-20% a year for a while. It's gotten a little bit better this last year, but it's tough. You know, when the Oregon Nurses Association has to be concerned about whether or not they can afford to insure, you know, their part-time workers, you've got a problem in your system. I think what this measure means philosophically is that we're taking a step that many other nations in this planet have taken, which is to say that we're recognizing a fundamental right. But I think what it really means philosophically for the state is that you're making a long-term commitment to say healthcare is part of your responsibility the way education, transportation, fire, and police are part of your responsibility. I think that is a positive step. That's what we're trying to encourage. Literally, I think what you're saying is that you've taken on this project. It's not a complete project. This isn't an answer. This isn't 329. This isn't any of the cost containment measures. This is a value statement codified in the Constitution and giving yourself a charge, if people affirm this, to take on these issues for the long term. I think that's a good thing. I think the alternative to that good thing is to let things continue on the path they're on, and the path that they're on is not going to lead us to a happy place. The path that they're on is employers are no longer going to be able to insure their employees. You know, a decade from now, I doubt that the employer-based healthcare system that we have now will maintain itself. You'll have your young and your old in the state, young, assuming that we pass the Healthy Kids Plan. Sorry, a little pitch back. You're old if you continue to have Medicare funded by the federal government, and you're very sick through either Medicaid as people spend down to get poor enough to afford that product, or in the emergency rooms covered. And everybody else will be in the shrinking group of insured people in the middle, where one bad thing in their life changes everything. You're saying that's not acceptable. So I'm going to leave my comments at that. I've noticed that you have some exciting questions, so I'm prepared.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, actually I do have one. Mm-hmm. What would be your comments if this doesn't pass? If it goes to the people and the people don't pass this ballot measure?
Well, yeah, it'd be disappointing, but I think in some ways it is the true test, right? I mean, if the public does not affirm that they have a right to health care access, I think we should listen to that. I think that that's an agreeable position. I liken it to how we dealt with property rights, for example. I wasn't a supporter of ballot measure 37, but to some extent, when you had a property rights initiative that says the voters have affirmed they have a property right, you have to listen to that. You have to accept even something that you didn't believe at the beginning to be true is truth, and come into this process and say, this is not about a program. This is about where do people believe their relationship with the state exists. What is the boundaries of that relationship? What are the rights involved? And if they say this isn't one of them, then that too gives you guidance, I would think, as a legislative body to say, okay, well, then the people have spoken.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Gail Atterbury?
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Gail Atterbury, and I'm the director of Oregon Right to Life. And I am here in opposition to HJR 18. And one of the main reasons is because, as it is written and as I understand it, it is extremely broad. And because of its broadness, it requires me to be in opposition to the bill for two main reasons. And the first is the vast potential of ending up with patient health care. There are only so many dollars to go around and amount of services that are needed. And the inevitable result will be rationing of health care, as I understand this bill to speak at the moment. I'd like to start out with a personal experience of mine. I have good health. Okay. I have good health care insurance through my work. And within this last month, I was written a prescription by my doctor for a health need. And when I went to pick it up at the pharmacy, I realized that I was told that my insurance would not pay for the prescription. It was expensive, but I wanted it and I needed it. And so I took my own money and I bought it. Very simple solution to the problem. That goes to show a good example of where I'm leading. Another example, or actually we have a lot of examples of health, of what we might call universal health care. And one of it, even though this isn't exactly pertinent, I mean exactly a dollar or oranges for oranges, apples for apples, it still speaks to the problem. In the VA hospital system, which is basically for VA veterans, they cover drugs. They only pay for 32% of the drugs available are out there. And this is one instance that veterans can access everything that is available. And so basically their drug capabilities are rationed. What we see in universal health care, we see in Britain. Now, there's lots and lots of examples of that, and so I'm only going to say a couple of examples that I found. The London's Observer newspaper carried a story in 2002 saying that an unpublished report shows some patients are now having to wait more than 8 months for treatment, during which time many of the cancers become incurable. The WHO, the United Nations organization, report that was reported, actually published that year, reported that around 10,000 British people die unnecessarily from cancer each year, and that's because it took so long for them to actually get to the doctor that they were being referred to. I think the closer example that we're all familiar with is Canada and their national health care system. The Vancouver, British Columbia-based Fraser Institute has a yearly publication titled Waiting Your Turn. Its 2006 edition gives waiting times by treatments from a person's referral by a general practitioner to a treatment by a specialist. The shortest waiting time for oncology is 4.9 weeks. The longest waiting time for an orthopedic surgery was 40 weeks. Median wait for a CT scan across Canada was 4.3 weeks, and Canada's median wait for an MRI was 10.3 weeks. Despite the long waiting times, Canadians suffer sometimes which results in death. Under their federal law, private clinics are not legally allowed to provide services covered by the Canada Health Act. There is help, however, for Canadian patients, and I think we are all familiar with that help. They come across the border to the U.S., where they can actually pay for the medical care that they would desire. That way they can get timely, life-saving care. In light of these known problems with universal health care, as well as we all know, and I know that's what you're struggling with here, is how difficult it is to discern with our own Oregon health plan how to use what limited dollars that are available for health care, I propose an answer to the problem in this HJR 18, and that would be an amendment which assures that Oregon residents maintain the right to spend their own money to obtain health care when they so choose. That would eliminate any rationing potential in this HJR 18. Another concern I have is abortion and assisted suicide. I have included a letter from our National Right to Life attorney. It's in your packet. And the second paragraph is what I will start reading. The term health care, as used in this proposal, is extremely vague. It contains no definition, nor does it have any limitation on the term. Therefore, this undefined, unlimited term could be interpreted to require any plan adopted by the Legislative Assembly to include coverage for abortion on demand for any reason or for no reason at all. Due to this vagueness, NRLC strongly recommends that Oregon Right to Life oppose this resolution unless it is amended to exclude abortion on demand from its coverage. Assisted suicide and most abortions are elective procedures and are not necessary for the preservation of life or health or for the safeguard of human life and dignity. As a matter of fact, each procedure terminates a life, no matter how small or how ill that life may be. Assisted suicide and abortion, in fact, directly contradict the stated purpose and mission of this resolution. HJR 18, in fact, says it is to safeguard human life and dignity. Unlike prenatal care or cancer treatment, abortion and assisted suicide are elective procedures that hold moral and ethical problems for a large percentage of Oregonians. I would suggest another amendment to HJR 18, one that states abortion, except in cases of life of the mother or in cases where there is a serious life-impairing condition to the mother, is exempted from this act. And as a third amendment, I would suggest one that states that nothing in this act would be construed to cover assisted suicide. Thank you.
Any questions? I ask you one. If it had those three amendments, would your organization then become avid supporters?
We would not become avid supporters. We would just be neutral and be out of the picture.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
John Charles?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a market-oriented research center. And our fundamental interest actually is promoting individual liberty, so we think about these issues a lot. And I'd like to try and add some clarification from our standpoint, which is that we need to separate rights from entitlements. And what's being proposed in HJR 18 is a very expensive entitlement and not a right. Rights, natural rights, define what we are free to do without interference. Declaration of Independence was pretty simple. It says we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And not a guarantee of happiness, just the pursuit of it. We have a right to pursue the religion of our choice, or of no religion. Right of expression, right of assembly, right to keep and bear arms. And the full exercise of those rights by any of us does not diminish the exercise of those rights by any of you. They are essentially cost-free. There is no zero-sum game. So we can all pursue them without imposing costs on others. And that's why they're natural rights. Now, of course, to ensure that we actually get to use them, that can be an expense. In fact, that's why we have government at all. The proper role of government in a free society is to protect our rights from those who would diminish them. So therefore, we do pay into a common fund for public safety to enforce our rights. And of course, today's government goes far beyond merely enforcing those rights. But those are what are natural rights. What is proposed in this bill, of course, is not cost-free. It proposes a massive entitlement program and then sets up a zero-sum game, which is that if some of us want this right, we have to impose costs on others. And we've already seen this at play earlier, a couple weeks ago, when you were debating the primary bill, in which you decided that the politically powerless group of people who buy tobacco will be the ATM machine for your new bill to protect a certain group of people, therefore taking away the rights of those people who now have to pay for something. And that's a long downward spiral once you start doing that. Now, Senator Westland was very clear in saying earlier that, of course, this is not an entitlement to quote, it's not an unlimited health care, just adequate health care, whatever that might be. And I'd like to suggest that the genie is way out of the bottle on that case, at least in that sector of society where health care is already considered a right. I went to a one of those negotiations on my local school board a few years ago that starts about 2 in the afternoon and goes to 2 at night. And the primary reason why I went to 2 at night was because the school board and the teachers' union people kept coming and going, shuttling back and forth, arguing over this issue of health care cost containment, in which the union's position was, we have a great plan, we've never paid a penny, doesn't matter, the costs are going up over the next 3 years, we're not going to pay a penny. If they go up 10,000%, you, the board, will pay everything. The board's position was, we can't do that. We need a little cooperation here because then we suck money out of the actual classroom. And the union's position was, that's fine, we're not paying it. Back and forth, back and forth. And, of course, there was no easy resolution. There have been 2 strikes in that district, the Oregon Trail School District, in the last year, 10 years. And precisely because there is no market discipline in the government monopoly education system, as a result, in fact, of education being a right, there really was no resolution. And so we continue to have costs spiral out of control. And once you start that process, adequate becomes meaningless. Unlimited becomes what people want. And there is no way out of that bind. And I would suggest that the K-12 public school system is not a model we want to emulate because it's expensive, bureaucratic, no consumer sovereignty, no ability to take money and move, have unsatisfied customers go elsewhere, and no matter how much we spend, the advocates always say it's not enough, and they can't actually tell you how much is enough. So I guess I would just conclude by saying we all have a right to pursue a career, to get a job, and to seek to pay for food, shelter, clothing, electricity, health care from our paycheck. And as a matter of compassion, we should help those who can't get that. And in the health care field, we mostly already have those entitlements anyway. But to say, to put this in the Constitution, that this is a right, confuses a right with an entitlement, and I would suggest that that's really not a path we should go down, because once you do, there are probably an infinite number of services that we could put in the Constitution as rights, and there would be no way, essentially, to pay for them now or in the future. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, can I explore this with our guests just very briefly?
Yeah, for a bit. It would be great to have a long conversation.
It would be, and I'm very interested in the subject, and I was sort of schooled in an Anglo-American school of philosophy that had a very similar perspective on rights that you do, so I find this very interesting. Do we have a right, in your opinion, to free education?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chair Cannon, no.
How about to fire protection?
I think we, to the extent that government or that someone can help protect our property, that's a useful expression of the government's power, because it's helping to protect our rights.
Let me just ask one
although it
doesn't,
wouldn't have to necessarily be provided by the government. There are privately provided fire services.
How about roads? Similar, I suppose it's in a similar place.
I would side with the 3 different presidents in the 19th century, all of whom vetoed legislation for a national highway system on the grounds that it was clearly unconstitutional. And early roads and other forms of infrastructure, in fact, were all provided by private providers charging user fees.
So you wouldn't agree with a previous speaker who suggested that these are core functions of government, of our state or local government? Fire safety, roads, free education.
Vice Chair Cannon, most of them are not. I would say public safety, enforcing the rule of law, protecting our rights from others, those are core functions of government. That is the fundamental reason we agree to have government, in my view.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'd like to ask some questions, but I won't know about whether the guy wanting to have a hog farm next to my property is protecting his rights or violating my right, but I think this isn't the time for it. Mr. Charles, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ellen Pinney, last witness. We'll go over a little bit, but not too much, I hope.
I'll just take a few minutes. For the record, my name is Ellen Pinney. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony today. Our coalition endorsed the HOPE initiative, and a number of our member organizations, including Oregon Action and Rich Rohde in Medford, were very active in collecting signatures. I wish Rich could be here today. This is a constitutional amendment establishing health care as a right. I say it's about time, and it's way past time that we take action to establish health care right in this state and in this nation. Perhaps if Oregon's efforts can join with the efforts of other states that are moving in the same direction, including our neighbor to the south, where we have hope something's going to happen there. We have the Dirigo plan in Maine, Massachusetts plan, Illinois plan, Florida. Maybe then Congress will take action, as the federal government did in Canada when several provinces enacted health care as a right in their provinces. The federal government up there said, each one of you have to have a plan in place by a date positive that includes these five components. Canada might be a bad place to compare ourselves to, given the comments that many people have made about Canada, but there are many other examples to draw from. There's Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland, and England, and Finland, and France, and Germany, and Italy, and every other industrialized nation in the world, and none of those healthcare systems are the same. They're all very different. They're different in terms of how they ask people to pay for it, whether it's employee payroll taxes, employer payroll taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, gross receipts taxes. There's as many ways of paying for health care for all as there are ways of collecting money. And there's as many ways of establishing a delivery system. This amendment is not predefining how you as a legislature would choose to take action to establish health care as a right. It is just asking you to do so by a date positive. As you've heard before, and I just want to say, we can do it, and we can do much better than we're now doing. As a country, we spend twice the amount of money on health care than any other industrialized nation in the world, yet we produce least in terms of infant mortality, in terms of rate of infant immunization, and in terms of life expectancy. 31% of our health care dollar goes out the door to administrative costs because of the fragmentation of our healthcare system, because so many different payers are paying providers so many different rates of reimbursement for the exact same procedure. There are other reasons to establish healthcare as a right and to move to get to universal coverage. And those reasons include the ability of Oregon businesses to compete in a global economy where every other nation's healthcare needs are being taken care of at a much lower cost than our own. Half of all bankruptcies are a result of medical debt, and three-quarters of those are a result of from people who already have health insurance. So one of the fastest-growing rates of medical bankruptcies are, in fact, among people who have health insurance. This crisis is not just about the uninsured in Oregon. It is about the growing numbers of underinsured in Oregon. I have high hopes that this legislative session will, in fact, give us a roadmap to get to health care for all. You have a number of proposals out there. Each of them have their strengths. Each of them have their weaknesses. But you can't say you lack for proposals. You have Senate Bill 329, which was the Senate Commission on Health Access and Affordability. You have the Archimedes proposal, which you're going to hear about. You're going to have the Health Policy Commission proposals. And you have this proposal.
And some more.
Oh, and there, excuse me, Mr. Chair, there will be more. But this proposal, if by passing this HJR 18 joint resolution, you give Oregonians the opportunity to vote on establishing health care as a right, and regardless of what you do or don't do this session, at the point they have made their intent clear, Oregon can never look back. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Well, thank you very much. We've completed the requested public testimony. We're going to hold open the public testimony. We're going to hold open for a public hearing and a possible work session in the subcommittee Wednesday night. We will have a full committee meeting on Friday night. We've got some bills. We've got some possible introductions of committee bills as well. So I will close the work session. I'm sorry, the public hearing on HJR 18 and adjourn the meeting.